Josh Constein from TechCrunch explains why Facebook won't let you advertise on your disaster videos. Serenity Caldwell from iMore has some thoughts on the new iPhones. And Liz Segrin from Fast Company is here to discuss her controversial article on the ex-Googlers who are coming for our bodegas. All that and so much more coming up on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1852, recorded Wednesday, September 13th, 2017. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage just for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/TNT. Hello and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about some of the biggest tech news stories with people, journalists who are passionate about writing about technology, and they're passionate about technology too. I'm Megan Maroney. Jason Howell is at Mobile World Congress Americas. So let's get right to the news. Today, Facebook announced formal rules around what content is eligible to earn revenue. Joining us to discuss what Facebook accepts into the program and what they've banned is Josh Constein from TechCrunch. Welcome back to the show, Josh.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's start first with what Facebook content can be monetized. Who gets to monetize their content?
So basically publishers, video creators, instant article publishers, and outside websites can use Facebook's different monetization tools. So that includes things like video ad breaks that get inserted in the middle of videos, ads that get hosted inside of the instant articles that Facebook actually keeps inside of its app, and also the Facebook Audience Network, which is basically like the Facebook ad network that's powered by all of Facebook's targeting. And you can promote and monetize almost any kind of content except for this set of new things that Facebook banned today.
Okay, so what, it's an interesting list. What have they banned?
So we got tragedy and conflict, which is anything with like real world tragedy, terrorism, natural disasters. There's debated social issues, which includes, you know, incendiary or inflammatory content. There's violence, adult content, pornography, drugs, swearing, and inappropriate language. But I think what's most interesting about all of this is that it doesn't matter if you're sharing this kind of content to glorify it, like you're some kind of troll or some, you know, somebody who's just trying to shock or annoy people, or if you're sharing it out of, you know, awareness of a natural disaster or a terrorist event or news broadcast, Facebook doesn't care. It doesn't matter what the context is. You cannot monetize this kind of content.
So what about like drugs? It says you can't have content about drugs. What if I decide I'm going to produce an anti-drug video, with an egg or something on a pan? can I monetize that, or is that considered drug content?
Yeah, even if it's something that's designed to like discourage something happening in the world, you still can't monetize it. Because the idea is that Facebook wants to avoid the brands and clients that it works with as advertisers from having their integrity jeopardized by having their content placed and their, you know, their publishers placed next to ads that people don't want. So basically, if you're a brand and you're trying to advertise on Facebook, Facebook wants to make sure you're not going to get put on anything that would make it seem weird. Like, for example, sure, like a broadcast about the hurricane in Florida recently, you know, that seems like pretty innocuous. But if you're, if you're a brand that sells umbrellas, it might seem really insensitive if you actually advertise on a news broadcast about the hurricane. And so Facebook's trying to protect against that and also protect that family-friendly content feel that you get on the social network.
So they're in some ways are sort of trying to protect brands from themselves, because that's what we always see, like on Twitter, especially when a brand takes advantage of some sort of, something that happened, some tragedy, I know there were a lot of people when gay marriage was legal. There were all these brands that were suddenly, you know, in rainbow colors, and it was kind of seen as distasteful. It wasn't a tragedy, but it was like you're making money off of this thing and just showing off your brand. So maybe they're protecting brands from themselves.
Yeah, they're definitely protecting brands from themselves. But at the same time, any type of incentive that you put in place is going to change the kind of content that gets produced. So if Facebook isn't going to allow you to monetize content about social justice issues, whether that's gay rights or Black Lives Matter or very important social issues, or something about like terrorism or a natural disaster, Facebook just doesn't necessarily want that content on its site because it knows that it's polarizing. It knows that it stirs up some people. It might not necessarily be appropriate for everyone in the family. And so Facebook, just by saying you can't monetize it, is going to implicitly cause less of that content to occur. And so while it's not purposefully censoring that content directly, it may cause publishers to self-censor and say, hey, let's do our news broadcast about feel-good topics where we can actually make money on them.
So like anyone, you know, if I've been posting about social justice or anything, like I can continue still doing that. My monetization plan for my life is not my Facebook videos. But what you're saying is that, you know, a news site, a journalist, you know, not my personal site, but a site, maybe even like us, like Twit, like if we're not going to talk about politics so much and post those videos on YouTube if we're trying to make money off of them.
Yeah, exactly. You know, for normal people, this isn't something they're going to have to worry about. You're going to be able to post whatever you want to your Facebook profile. Facebook's not banning discussion of any of these topics. What it's saying is that if you're the kind of person who's making new shows for the Facebook Watch original video tab, or you're, you know, a big news outlet who publishes articles, you can still do that and discuss these topics, but you just can't make money off of them. But that what happens when you do that is you just implicitly push the content in a certain direction. And, you know, Facebook is really reeling from all the accusations after it, after the election, where it was thought to have influenced the election negatively. You know, there's new reports coming out that Russians bought ads that were designed to sway political voters. They even hosted and promoted events on Facebook. And so Facebook is very sensitive about this right now, because it doesn't want to see suddenly that advertisers think, oh my God, there's all this propaganda, there's all this political talk, all this polarizing content, we don't want our ads on there anymore. And so this is definitely something where Facebook is trying to protect its own bottom line. And by doing that, it is slipping much closer to becoming a media company. You know, Facebook has always said that it's a technology company, and that's good for it, because if you're a tech company, you can't be held liable for the content that gets posted on your social network. That's just part of the U.S. law, that it doesn't matter. As long as you're a tech platform and you're pretty agnostic about what gets uploaded, you can't be held responsible. But a media company that chooses what gets shown on its site, they can be held liable if they post something that's against the law. And so I think Facebook here is treading much closer to being a media company, because it's making what is akin to editorial decisions just by making these incentives about what is and isn't monetizable.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, they sound a little bit like my grandmother, who used to say, like, no politics at the dinner table, no religion, no politics at the dinner table. Everybody be nice to each other. And that, I mean, that's not what Facebook really is.
Yeah, I think the problem here is that, well, these are things that maybe a brand doesn't want to have next to them, and maybe they're not necessarily always acceptable for all ages of people. The problem is that these are critical topics for us to be discussing. Like, social justice issues are things that the world really needs to hear about. And if there's a reason why people aren't going to post about that stuff on Facebook, it could have a significant effect on what the discourse is in our country and in our planet.
Does YouTube have these same rules?
YouTube does have some pretty specific rules around what isn't monetizable. And I'm not exactly familiar about the specifics, but they definitely don't allow anything with a hate speech in it or abject violence. But I think the more social justice type stuff, where it's not necessarily something that would get your movie slapped with an R rating, for instance. It's not nudity, it's not graphic violence, but it's just stuff that not everyone is always comfortable with, or that it can be polarizing. You know, that's the kind of stuff that Facebook is saying isn't necessarily allowed. And I think YouTube has been a bit more lenient on that. But they definitely had this big problem with what they called the adpocalypse, where after PewDiePie, who was this big game streamer who, you know, is a celebrity on YouTube, started saying some really nasty things, all of a sudden advertisers realized, oh my God, our ads are appearing on his content and we're being associated with those negative points of view. And suddenly a whole bunch of advertisers pulled back from YouTube. YouTube stopped allowing a whole lot of people from monetizing their content. Those creators got angry and they said, you know, we're going to look for somewhere else who will pay us. And when Facebook came out saying, we're going to pay you 55% of the ad revenue, not just this tiny fraction like YouTube does, but you know, the majority of the ad revenue, I think a lot of those creators said, oh, I want to flock to Facebook. But this might give them pause because they're going to have to be pretty specific about what the kind of content they produce. Otherwise, they're not going to make any money.
Right. So to be clear, this is about ads and monetizing your content. It's not what it's not. They have completely different community guidelines for what you can post and not post. This is specifically ad guidelines if you want to make money off of your stuff.
Exactly. In terms of what you can and can't post on Facebook, you can't post hate speech, you can't post nudity, but you can post, you know, sexually suggestive content. You can post things that discuss debated social issues, but now you can't monetize them. And so I think as long as people understand that, it's going to be all right. But I worry that people are going to get caught up and say, oh, this is Facebook really censoring content. It's not. They're not directly censoring content, but that's the crux of it. The subtle problem with this is that over time, if every publisher has to choose, well, I can make a movie or I can make a video about, you know, these civil rights protests, or I could make them make a video about puppies, they're going to say, oh, well, the puppies one I can make money on. And that's going to subtly shift the discourse in that kind of sterile direction, which isn't going to get us anywhere in a world where we really need to address the hardcore social issues facing our planet.
Well, Josh, thank you so much for joining us. Josh Constein is an editor at large for TechCrunch and can be found at Josh Constein on Twitter. Will you be at Disrupt next week?
I absolutely will be. Yeah, and you guys can always find me on Twitter. I'm
awesome.
Happy to talk to anyone.
All right. Well, I hope to see you next week. I will be there too. So take care of yourself.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. We've had almost 2 days to digest Apple's big event, and it's fair to say that the verdict on the iPhone 8 and the iPhone 10 isn't in yet, mostly because most of us haven't seen or touched the phones in real life. One person who was at the event and who has strong opinions on all things Apple is Serenity Caldwell from iMore. Welcome back to the show, Serenity.
Thanks for having me, Megan. Always fun to be on Tech News Today.
Well, thank you so much. So I want to get to your experience going down the stairs and being in the hands-on. But first, I want to ask you, why do you think the iPhone X is so expensive?
I honestly think it's almost entirely to do with the new Face ID camera array. I mean, the technology that's gone into that thing, I mean, the Face ID aside, Face ID is a really cool feature and it's really interesting from a perspective of biometric security, what they're doing in that feature. But all of this, all of the background technology that they have done to make Face ID as reliable as it is, and also the fact that, you know, you can use it for portrait mode because it has that depth map and everything else, and the craziness, like 30,000 dots, invisible dots on your face, making a live map of your face that can measure changes, can measure if you're smiling or frowning, and, you know, track you for live. The Animoji demos are crazy. I tried it in the hands-on demo room, and I was quite frankly shocked at how well it was. And after the demo, after the hands-on, one of my friends who's in the VFX industry actually sent me a message. She's like, I watched your hands-on and I want to know what the heck Apple's magic sauce is to track faces that well without any extra gear, because, you know, once we figure this out, this is going to be game changing for the VFX industry in terms of like previs, in terms of everything else. And I think they're absolutely right. It's like it's a tremendous monumental amount of technology that they've shoved into the phone. So the OLED panel obviously is costing money. The fact that they have a much better rear camera telephoto sensor, or not sensor, telephoto lens with f2.4 instead of f2.8 aperture, so you get better low light photos. That's really important. But I honestly think it's the front facing camera array. Like that is a lot of really, really impressive tech in a small space.
And so that notch or that chin, what are you calling it? A notch or a chin or a...
The ears.
Ears. Okay.
Ears.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. A mock-up on Twitter today of someone putting the notch in the apple. And now I want to see the reverse. I want to see someone doing the bite of the apple on an iPhone 10 prototype. So I'm like, you could make the notch even cuter. Little ears. It's just a little apple bite.
So calling it a notch is like glass half empty and calling it ears is glass half full.
Yeah. It just makes me think of Mickey Mouse. So sure.
Do you think you get used to it? I mean.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I honestly got used to it. The watching video is a little weird. But as I discovered when I was playing around with it, you can double tap on the screen and it will actually change the aspect ratio. So it will go from sort of this slightly zoomed in look to regular 16 by 9, which removes kind of the ears. And it just makes it look like a regular bezel. Honestly, it makes it look like it has a top and a bottom. People are like, oh, you have horizontal bars. And how weird is that? And I'm kind of looking at my existing iPhone 7 Plus, and I'm thinking, I already have horizontal bars. They're called the bezel. So it basically, yeah, in any app that's not activated to take advantage of, you know, that extra notch screen space, it's really just a bezel. It's a bezel. And it looks like a bezel. It looks just black. It's only honestly on the home screen that you notice it, where you're just like, oh, it's weird that it just kind of loops up like that. Or as I said, if you're watching zoomed in video or zooming in on your photos. So I don't know. I'm actually, part of me is like, did Apple really need to make that part a screen? But because they added that extra space, now you have space for things like the time or signal strength along those lines. So I think we'll get used to it. I think it will be, you know, in the same category as the headphone jack from last year, where we'll get over it.
And so in your hands-on, you took a look at the photo features, the new, I don't know what the name of it, but you can remove the background. And did you like that?
Yeah, portrait lighting.
Portrait lighting.
Yes.
Did you like it?
I do, honestly. I was expecting, I mean, of course, we have to sort of address the elephant in the room, which is the leaks from last weekend. So, and as part of those leaks, we heard, oh, there's going to be a feature called portrait lighting. And all of us are scratching our heads and being like, well, how is that going to work? And what Apple has basically said is, oh, well, we're going to use this depth map that we have of your face, and we're going to use it to artificially basically lighten and darken certain areas to make it look like you have various lighting rigs pointed at your face. And it's something that, again, you've been able to do in Photoshop for quite a long time, but it's taken a lot of different effort. You know, you actually have to be very, very good at knowing where to lighten and where to darken and where to put highlights and where to put lowlights. And this basically does it all at once and live while you're doing it, which is kind of... terrifying, honestly, to know that this CPU has that much power and can analyze your depth map, you know, on the fly and do all of this. But the fact that it's technically a beta feature, probably like portrait mode, it won't exit beta until maybe early next year. But even as a beta feature, I found it remarkable just how natural some of the lighting looks. There are five different lighting modes. There's kind of a natural lighting, which just adds like a little bit of fill here and there. There's what one person dubbed the contrast filter, which Instagrammers are going to love, which basically just adds high contrast depth to your face and makes it look like you're basically on the stage of a studio show. There's, as you mentioned, the removal of the background. I believe that's called Spotlight. Or maybe it might be Studio Light. I can't quite remember which one it is. No, not Studio Light. Hey, look, Stage Light. There we go. Thanks for helping me out, iPhone page. So Stage Light isolates the background using, again, that depth map from the rest of you and instantly blacks it out, creating, again, like a stage portrait, like you're standing on stage and being under a bright spotlight. And this is all cool from a basics perspective, But what I'm really, really excited about is what developers are going to do with this in the next couple months, because all of the portrait, you know, the portrait mode APIs are available for developers to play with, including the gradations and like how much. And I'm already testing apps that do very similar things for blur. And I'm really curious to see, like, I'm sure we're going to get God knows how many different lighting filters and crazy things, or, you know, oh, let's replace the background and put absolutely wacky things behind you. It's a new era of green screen, basically. So yeah, I am pretty bullish on portrait lighting. I think it's pretty cool.
So the name, they went with the iPhone 10 instead of the mm-hmm. iPhone Pro, and
or the iPhone X,
or the iPhone X, which some people will call it that. But so they, and with the iPad Pro, you could always justify. I mean, you as an artist, you could always justify. Well, you know, I need to pay more because I'm a professional. I'm going to use this for drawing. But is there any sort of? I mean, who is this phone for besides reviewers?
That's a great question. Honestly, I think this is the phone for the people who, I mean, I hate to use the cheesy line that they used on stage, but it really is. It's the people who want tomorrow's iPhone today, who aren't afraid to pay a premium for extra features. I think what they're basically saying are acknowledging that, hey, if you want an OLED screen, we're not going to give you an OLED screen until we can deliver a biometric security experience that's better than trying to stick your finger on the back of a phone, mm-hmm. which clearly, I mean, we saw the prototypes, you know, the various leaks that have gone out. Clearly, Apple tried this and just didn't like it, which is why they got rid of it and why they're not going with it, because they thought it was a subpar experience. And that's kind of Apple to its core, is that they're not going to ship things if they think they're a subpar experience. So I'm like, and again, this is completely me guessing here, but I'm figuring while they're on the line of, you know, developing their next phone, they come at a crossroads where they're like, we really want to do OLED. We have a way that we can do a really fantastic screen and do it justice. That's full screen, but we're running into this authentication problem. And we have this really amazing, you know, Face ID technology, but it's going to cost a lot of money to implement, basically. That this is not going to be something that we can sell at the regular iPhone price. And to me, iPhone 10 is basically their compromise, where they're saying, we want to give users the experience, the true experience, right? And I think back to the original iPhone, where the first year of the original iPhone, I mean, that was a pretty steep price to ask early adopters to pay. It was, mm-hmm. what, $599, $699, unlocked, you know, not on, like, you basically were paying the entire price of the phone. And the next year, Steve Jobs was like, all right, maybe we, or maybe even not, I think it was like 6 or 7 months later, he's like, okay, we're going to discount it. Mm-hmm. And we're going to give rebates to people who bought recently, because we realized that this is not exactly the price that we want the average user to pay. And the original iPhone suffered, or not suffered, but it really didn't have a super giant adoption until we saw the iPhone 3G and the iPhone 3GS. And I think this is the same thing, where if you want the latest, the future of the smartphone, as Apple is want to call it, if you want the OLED screen with, again, some of the most amazing technology that I have seen crammed into the top bezel of a smartphone, and if you want a superior rear camera, and honestly, a superior selfie camera, I can see a lot of people who are either Instagrammers or people who are wannabe Instagrammers, people who really care about the quality of their phone camera, as well as, you know, the ability to take really crisp photos on the go. I think there's a lot to be said about the appeal of this thing. Yes, it's expensive, but when we get down to it, very few of us, except for gadget reviewers, pay for the thing outright. You know, the idea of plunking down $999 or $1,149 for a phone outright, it doesn't happen the way that we do with the iPad Pro. Instead, we pay in installments. We either pay in a 2-year contract, or we pay month to month via one of the upgrade plans, either through your carrier or, if you're in the US, the Apple upgrade program. And I think that's where people are going to realize, oh, this isn't actually that much more money. for an iPhone 8 Plus, I might be paying like $34 a month under the upgrade program. And for an iPhone 10, I might be paying closer to like $45, $50 a month. So if they can, you know, if they can justify it to themselves being like, yeah, I guess I can go out for dinner one less time per month and then afford an iPhone 10, I think that's a lot easier for people to swallow. Mm-hmm. But you're right, Megan, like this is a phone that is not for everybody. It's not priced for everybody because they simply can't make it work. And that's why the iPhone 8 and the iPhone 8 Plus still exist, because there has to be this in between until Apple can get the component costs down to where they want it to be to sell this kind of a phone to everybody.
But the iPhone 8, I mean, especially the iPhone 8 Plus, is not that much cheaper.
No, it's not, honestly. But that's the thing is we look at the iPhone 8 Plus, right? Which has a starting price, I forget off the top of my head, but it's something like in the $700-$800 range, right? It's not, you know, super cheap unlocked.
Yeah, I think again, it's $799 for the
$799 for an iPhone 8 Plus. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about $200 more essentially for an OLED screen and the Face ID camera system. Which not only gets you Face ID, but it gets you front-facing portrait mode. It gets you all of the augmented reality benefits that come from a front-facing depth map and depth sensors. So all of that stuff you get for $200, which is really, again, if you look at it in terms of specific components, it's not that much more of a leap than the iPhone 8 to the iPhone 8 Plus for that dual camera system, which is really the big seller between those two, other than, you know, getting a slightly larger screen for your money. So I when I come down to it, it's all smartphones are expensive, right? All smartphones are going to be expensive. And the more we get into future technology and the further we ramp up into that arena, the further that we're going to get into having to pay a certain amount to justify a premium for our phones.
So I want to talk about the Steve Jobs Theater and the new Apple campus a little bit, because the pictures looked amazing. What was that experience like? How did the chairs feel?
It was wonderful reported. Well, first of all, Apple campus was very impressive to visit. I was very, very grateful to have the opportunity to go. Obviously, you know, there are only so many people who can fit in that theater, and iMore has a lot of talented people. So I was happy to get the invite, happy to be able to experience the campus in progress as it was. The Steve Jobs Theater, I think the thing that really stands out to me is I used to work for Apple Retail. So I have kind of a firsthand knowledge and feeling about Apple's architecture and the way that they design buildings, the way that they design their products to work in and around buildings. And I'm just so impressed with what they've been able to do from a standpoint of making something that is essentially a giant glass building with marble steps, the ultimate Apple store in a way, the ultimate Apple store into a theater. And that's the beauty of this thing is this giant, you know, it's the Fifth Avenue Cube, rethought, where we have, again, a subterranean, experience, except now instead you go down and you go into this very open theater, which felt kind of like a supersized town hall where it's a lovely dig, you know, graded slant with these beautiful, I'm not sure if they're actual leather or pleather chairs. And then you have this cylinder in the middle there. We're all like, well, this is an interesting, you know, cylinder. It's probably some top secret lair for Apple's employees. We go and we, you know, sit down, experience the sound, which was incredible. Like of course the sound is going to be incredible. But it's something where, you know, they've put a lot of care and a lot of time into thinking about this and thinking about the way that, you know, it of all memorials to Steve Jobs. And I still wonder if Steve Jobs really wants a memorial in the first place, given him being him, but if Steve Jobs had to have a memorial, this is a pretty nice one. It's a pretty good one for him. Especially the feel of the theater, the feel of where the presenters, where it can be intimate, but at the same time expansive. and have room for everybody to sit and interact and chat. The fact that the executive level benches are quite literally benches. They're like love seats, almost movie theater seats, with the higher seats reserved for sort of individual seats with power. Very nice, oh. Apple. Thank you for that. But the experience of the keynote was one of the better press events that I've been to. And then I think the really nice thing is you come up the stairs after the event and this giant cylinder that you've noticed in the middle of the room has actually shifted like a Disney attraction, basically, to the wall removes and it reveals a gigantic hands-on area in the subterranean, you know, lobby, basically. So there's no rushing to stand in a queue to get, you know, 20 at a time to go see the new iPhone in a small huddled space. Instead, you have this very airy, very expansive space where Apple can set out their gadgets and let people mill it well. Now, granted, there were a bunch of us in that theater, so it was still very crazy. And there was still, you know, a lot of camera folks and a lot of people vying to see the new iPhone 10 and the 8 and the 8 Plus and the Apple Watch. So it was still pretty crowded. As somebody who was taking a lot of video during that event, I don't love the fact that Apple has these spotlights that shine directly on the devices. You can see a little bit in my hands-on. There's just this mm-hmm. like silhouette of four different little glowy lights.
Yeah.
Which I'm just like, really, Apple, you had the chance to design something for press to, you know, enjoy your hands-on area, and it's still frustrating to film. There's those little glowy dots.
Yeah.
Oh gosh. They were a challenge to be sure. But I will say that tiny little nitpick aside, it was otherwise a very, very cool experience.
So you are a roller derbyist. Is that roller derby?
roller derby player.
Yeah. And you know, you posted your gear bag on iMore and you brought your skates. Were you intending or hoping to skate around in the theater?
You know, I very seriously considered bringing my skates and filming. I've been doing little how-tos and tutorials and exercise videos on my Instagram lately as part of, you know, training for the Team Canada World Cup, which is coming up next February. And there was a part of me that was like, it would be really fun to roller skate around Apple Park. But that part of me was weighing the part of me of, do I really want to get kicked out of the first Apple event at Apple Park and never get invited back? So that was like weighing around. And I eventually decided not to bring the skates. But in retrospect, I'm kind of sad that I didn't, because there were some epic hills that I feel like could have been really, really fun to roller skate. So maybe next time.
Yeah.
Maybe next time.
iPhone 9 or iPhone 11 or whatever comes next.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. iPhone X2, the X.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I didn't even get a chance to talk to you about the Apple Watch. So check out iMore. Take a look at Serenity's hands-on. She looks at the new Sport Loop. Go to the website. Serenity, thank you so much for your time. Enjoy San Francisco. Serenity Caldwell is the managing editor at iMore and is at Setern on Twitter. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Megan.
Take care. After the break, Twitter went crazy today in defense of the bodega. Find out why. But first, let's take a minute to thank Rocket Mortgage, the sponsor of this episode. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You need it because you could buy a new iPhone or you could buy a house. And at least with a house, you can get a mortgage. But if you've been frustrated with the current mortgage experience, I want you to try Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage just the touch of a button. It's also powerful. So whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in just seconds. So you enter your income, your assets, your credit, and Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of that and get all of the home loan options that you qualify for and then they will find the one that is just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/TNT. That's rocketmortgage.com/TNT. Don't forget to add the TNT afterwards. That stands for Tech News Today. And that way they know you came from us to them. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. These days, it seems like the only thing Amazon can't compete with is our corner store where we buy things we need right this red hot second. One new startup thinks they can disrupt this economy with kiosks where you can pick up non-perishable items that you might pay more for at the mom and pop store down the street. Our next guest wrote about this startup called Bodega for Fast Company. Liz Segrin, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So tell us about Bodega.
So Bodega is basically creating little pantry boxes, much like, you know, the little lending libraries you might have in your neighborhood. They're just little boxes that are 2 feet by 5 feet. And they're full of the stuff that you might need, stuff that you would ordinarily get from a convenience store. And then you basically just use an app to open it, take out what you need, and the device automatically recognizes what you took out. So it's totally unmanned. It's a little tiny convenience store that doesn't require any human to man it.
So you wrote this story this morning on the day they launched, and then it took on a little bit of a life of its own. It was trending on Twitter. People love their bodegas. They also love their bodega cats. Was this surprising to you that so many people had such strong feelings about your piece?
Yeah, it was surprising how vast the reaction was. I mean, you know, when we were talking about it in our newsroom before I wrote it, a lot of us had pretty strong reactions at Fast Company to it. First of all, calling it bodega, which is a very culturally specific term that, you know, that's used by immigrant communities for a very beloved space, seemed wrong. But then also using that name for a product that could put a lot of those bodegas out of business seemed even more insensitive. So clearly we had a strong reaction to this. So when I was reporting the story, I decided to, you know, to ask them about, you know, their name. And then I also went out to various people who own bodegas and who are in charge of bodega associations to see what they thought. And so I put all of that into the story, and then it exploded today. I mean, everybody had the same reaction that we did, that there's something really problematic under the surface here.
Yeah, it's so interesting because Mike Murphy from Quartz, who we have on the show often, also wrote a piece similar to yours, but he mentioned that maybe it wasn't the best idea to use the word, to call it bodega, but he didn't really take that angle at all. And, you know, it was a very different reaction. What I loved about your piece is you specifically asked the creators, do you ask them this question? It wasn't like you just sprung this on them. You asked, does it seem strange that you would use the word bodega, and tell our audience how they responded to you.
So I asked Paul McDonald, the CEO and the founder, and he said, no, he didn't think that it was a problem. He understood where I was coming from, but he said that they did a survey in which they talked to people from the Latin American community, and 97% of them had no problem with it. And so that was kind of the end of the story for them. And so that really raises a lot of questions about who they were asking. And it sort of, you know, it makes you wonder whether they're really talking to many people who live in communities where there are bodegas. It didn't sound like they talked to many bodega owners. It seems like, you know, they were sort of isolated from the very communities whose names they were appropriating.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, it's not that different it's a vending machine. It's not like the service itself isn't really that shocking or different. You know, it's not that different than Fresh Direct or we used to have Cosmo back in the 90s. It was a service that in San Francisco where you would just go on a website and they would bring you whatever you wanted in an hour. And no one really said you're replacing the mom and pop store. How much of this, how much of the response on Twitter do you think was the fact that they are ex-Googlers? And I believe that was in your headline as well. Do you think people are feeling not so great about Google right now?
I don't think it's that at all. I honestly think that it has everything to do with the name. And I think that because there are so many other companies that are, eating the lunch of, you know, of the bodega owners, right? I mean, we're talking Amazon in New York, there's Fresh Direct. People are okay with using these services, even though they're killing off bodegas. It was really the idea that they would be so explicit about, competing directly with this particular institution, and then would appropriate the name. And also, it wasn't just the name, right? It was the logo is a cat. And there's this amazing meme of these bodega cats. And so it just seemed really insensitive because, you know, these bodegas are special places. They're places where people, you know, gather together. They talk about their day. There's somebody there who makes them a sandwich that they like. And then there are these little cats that live there that people love. And it was like they just appropriated the whole concept without thinking about the impact that would have.
And so do you think it was more of a cultural issue, like using that word and that culture and people have come here to support themselves? Or, I mean, do you think the same thing would have happened if Amazon had called itself Little Corner Bookstore?
I think it's definitely a cultural issue. And I think that we, you know, as a society, we've sort of been okay with having all these different companies come in and disrupt, jobs and disrupt institutions that we like. I mean, think about Uber, right? It's the same concept. But, you know, it would be as if Uber had used a racially charged, culturally specific term and just blatantly sort of gone after the livelihoods of taxi drivers while also appropriating some aspect of their culture. I think it was the combination of, you know, the name and what they were trying to do that really ticked people off. I don't actually think that the Google part was central to people's angst here.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that there were issues in the early days of Uber where they had names that sort of sounded like taxi and cab and they really, it was Uber cab, I think maybe they were called in the beginning.
Yeah. 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 I think so. Yeah. Right. And then they fixed it. Right. And they changed it. And so, I guess one question that's going to come up now is whether, whether Bodega is going to quietly change their name or what the best thing to do about the name is right now.
So Paul McDonald posted on Medium about sort of giving a half apology. Has he reached out to you or have you spoken with him today?
No, he never reached out to Fast Company specifically.
So, yeah, he sort of apologizes. But if you read the comments in the Medium post, there are a lot of people saying it was, a sorry, not sorry kind of thing. But I do wonder if they will change their name at this point.
Well, at the end of the article, they didn't say that they would. And they did say that they're thinking carefully about the reaction. I wonder what they're going to do now. I think they're probably having some difficult conversations over there.
Well, I mean, I think and a lot of people are saying like, oh, it's just a vending machine. It's no big deal. Everyone's freaking out on Twitter. But I think it's time to freak out a little bit about these kinds of things. Like as we move into, we just try to disrupt everything without thinking, without talking to people. So I really appreciate you writing this, Liz, and thanks for taking the time. Liz Segrin is a staff writer at Fast Company, and she is Liz Segrin on Twitter. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we got some feedback. Sean writes, regarding the conversation about discussing politics on TNT, Megan mentioned that many listeners have written in complaining about the discussion of politics on the show. While I completely understand the argument there, every day we are seeing major tech companies become more prominent in the political landscape, whether it's lobbying, more taking a public stance on political decisions. I think in all fairness, then it's a perfectly reasonable expectation to hear some degree of political discussion on a tech show, especially when these political discussions are impacted by or driven by the tech sector. Thank you so much for your email, Sean. I think that's a good feedback for today, especially considering what we talked about with Josh earlier about a lot of media just wanting us to be not talk about controversial issues. TNT's fan of the day is Jeff, who watches us on Twitch. There he is watching Jason from yesterday. You can watch live at so many places, but we really, really love it when you subscribe to the show. So you can subscribe at twit.tv/TNT and show us how you watch or listen to TNT, record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we're going to find it. And if you haven't yet watched Jack Film's parody of yesterday's iPhone announcement, please do yourself a favor and watch it right after the show. Here is a little preview for you.
Steve Jobs walked on stage and introduced a new product called the iPhone, marking a milestone in both technology and innovation. And to keep his spirit alive, we here at Apple are proud to announce the culmination of Steve's vision. Introducing the $1,000 emoji machine. This is what Steve would have wanted. Probably. The new iPhone X emoji comes in two new colors. You can't and afford it.
All right. Well, I don't want to give away too much of it. Go to Jack Film's YouTube channel and subscribe to his show. It is to his channel and watch all his ads because he is hilarious. And thank you for making those films. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. That's around 2300 UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show. You can email us at tnt@twit.tv. We love your messages. Send us a video. Just record a video. You can upload it to YouTube and then send that to tnt@twit.tv or record a voice message just on your own phone and email that to tnt@twit.tv. You can also find us on Twitter where you can post those YouTube videos at Tech News Today TV. Subscribe to our show. Go subscribe. Do it now. Even if you just watch live, we love it when you subscribe. And if you want to tweet at me, you can tweet at me. I'm at Megan Maroney. I take direct messages. They're totally open. So send me your videos. Send me your comments. Send everything. And thank you to our technical director, Anthony. Thank you to Burke for helping out in the studio. Thank you to Kevin for editing this show, which we created originally in tiny little pieces. And Kevin has to figure out how to sew them all up together. And thanks to you, whoever you are, for talking tech with us today. Jason will be back tomorrow, and we will see you then.